And welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Semmel, back from a couple of weeks off where one of us just went up north filming and one of us had an incredibly life-altering experience in getting married. Congratulations, John.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you so much.
And the other voice congratulating John was Mark Christensen. Hello, Mark. Welcome back.
Thanks.
Now, I should just point out for anyone that's listening that if you hear heavy breathing at my end, it's actually my dog who's incredibly glad that I've come back from shooting and will not leave me alone. So please don't think that I'm just that enthusiastic about this week's film, Quantum of Solace, that I've actually got down on all fours and bark raving mad. So it is the return of Bond and to a certain extent part two of what we saw with Casino Royale. So starting with you, John, what did you think?
Well, I thought it was spectacular. I actually, I'm going to probably damn myself to an eternal place of, you know, awfulness by saying that I preferred it over Casino Royale.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, wow. See, there you go. And the fight begins. But I also, when we walked out, I referred to it, Mark and I saw it together today. And when I walked out, I referred to it as Quantum of Budget. Because, my gosh. The number of locations and just items that were obliterated in this film were completely off the charts.
It was a spectacularly large budget for a spectacularly short film. What did you think, Mark?
Well put. I thought it was, you know, I'm trying to think of the right word to describe it, because to say it was really solid is so disrespectful. I mean, it's actually pretty spectacular without having so many of the just rock star huge effects shots that you might, you know, Roger Moore with a parachute or whatever that you might think of as being Bond. But it continued in this kind of cinema verite, you know, the Bond identity. It kind of went in that direction even further. And especially after I understood what kind of constraints they were under to get this film made, not that it seemed constrained, but now I'm just absolutely floored by what they pulled off.
Well, here's a few points that I'd like to make. Firstly, I really liked the film. I thought it was good, and I thought the visual effects were stunning. But if we just put the visual effects one side for a second, like I have three problems. Problem number one is it's the Bourne Identity problem, which is to say, I want a Bond film, not another Bourne Identity film. I like the Bourne Identity films. They're great, but they just do it better than the Bond does. In other words, Bond does Bond and Bourne Identity does Bourne Identity. And I don't think Bond doing Bourne Identity gets you something better. It just gets you a kind of slightly hollow in. Second problem I've got is that, and which leads from the first really, is that it was the quantum of plot for me, right? Like, or rather character development. Like, there was just nothing that drove us further forward in character as opposed to the first one. If we consider them to be a two-parter with Casino Royale, and I kind of missed that. Like, and then the third thing is, I genuinely think it wouldn't hurt them just to lighten up a fraction and have more gags than just the airline host of the Virgin America airline making martini cracks, which was pretty, you know, kind of about as far as it got in terms of a sense of humor.
Oh, I don't know. There were some other funny bits. I think the part where he faked the guy off his motorcycle by actually getting him to hit the gas and like wheelie it right out from under himself was just great slapstick comedy right there.
Yeah, or the point where M made the comment that, you know, how everyone says we have people everywhere, but they don't really mean it.
That was, you know, funny. I'll give you that. That was very funny. Okay. Maybe I'm being slightly harsh, but but it was a pretty dry film. I mean, it was a big budget. Like, there was $230 million we've got estimates of, compared to like $140 million on Casino Royale. It's done obviously extremely well, but, you know, I just felt like we could have had a bit more in there. We just felt like it was just, you know. Now, I think it's partly because it was just edited so quickly. Does anyone want to discuss that, Mark? Is that what you were alluding to before? Just how short they had in post?
Yeah. What was that? 12 weeks to post this thing, or 5 weeks to post it and 12 weeks to do the effects. Is that right?
And I mean, incredibly short amount of time. I don't quite get why that would be.
Well, I think because my guess is that a window of opportunity opened up. I mean, if you notice, even on the show, we haven't had a great long slate of films to cover, or maybe we just haven't been covering them, but I think maybe with the writer's strike and some other things going on in Hollywood, I think they saw an opportunity to dominate the box office if they could get this thing open on their big 11-7 opening, or 11-14, or I don't know even what it was in Australia, Mike. But so they, I mean, but yes, for anyone listening, I mean, they started shooting this thing in February. It's like, that's just amazing. Right. I mean, and they went to more locations. I mean, all that budget that you're talking about went to the locations, really. They went to, like, they went further afield, I think, than, I don't know, apparently than any Bond film has gone.
Or at least they were out of the famous Pinewood Studios more than any other Bond film on the road. But look, I mean, that's fine. Like, I think that's terrific. I think it's great that they're on the road. And I don't take anything away from it. But do you really think this is a great Bond film? I just felt like it was a good Bond film. It was just lacking the charm that's going to make me want to run back and watch it in years to come. You know, I mean, I understand it doesn't have any of the cheesy one-liners anymore because it's particularly unhip to say things like, you know, so you expect me to talk? No, I expect you to die, Mr. Bond. But, and I get that it's lost that, right? So it's cool. I understand that. It's hip to be wobbling the camera. But, I mean, it was so pared down.
Yeah. I mean, Casino Royale replaced all that old kind of old-style Bond grandiosity with, you know, I mean, if you think about Casino Royale, like, it had a truly scary torture sequence in it. Like, I don't think I'd ever seen Bond in that kind of danger before.
But, and I mean, let's not be blunt about this, right? I don't want to sound like the 40-year-old virgin, but they also toned down the sex scenes. I mean, like, you know, it's basically cut to her kissing her back. I mean, as a kid, I remember as a teenager, it was like, you know, the magnetic watch down the zipper and stuff.
Yeah. But I mean, think that trend's been going for a while then, Mike. I mean, we've been firmly in the era of safe sex for quite a while now.
He still shags somebody. He just cut to, like, him walking and taking his shirt off, and the next thing you know, he's, like, kissing her back and they're leaving. It's like, I mean,
well,
where's
the
floating
way,
in zero?
Sheet, yeah.
Yeah, where's the floating in zero's G sex that we enjoyed in Moonraker?
No, anyway, see, there you go. That's visual effects and sex married together. That's what we need.
But okay, but let's say for a second that we've taken out the fun, and we've taken out, that we also took out all the gadgets. I mean, there was, like, I understand that we're not allowed to have Q anymore because, it, you know, we'd gone to John Cleese and it had been the other chap that who I can't remember, the really famous Q guy. But there were no gadgets whatsoever. He didn't even have, like, the, you know, magnetic this or that, or the car. Okay, the car in Casino Royale with the car, he has a defibrillator, you know, like the paddle things, you know, thing which they connects. In this one, all they had was some good UI sequences, which, by the way, Mark, reminded me of the stuff that you're doing in FX PhD, but they didn't have anything. I mean, the car, basically, where are the laser-guided rockets? Where's the pop-up oil slicks? Where's the pop-out, the tin tacks at the back, or the underwater jumping off anything? I mean, he didn't have a door by the end of it, but I think that's just because it fell off. I mean,
well, it's worth saying, I mean, so much of this film, and this goes back to your complaint about the Bond identity. I mean, a ton of this film was shot in close up, and that's how you get a film done in such a short period of time. You know, I mean, there's a lot of excitement being that close in with a handheld camera to a lot of action. And that's not to discount anything they did, because they really knew what they were doing in planning this thing out. But I mean, the number of times that the camera just even pulled back enough to give you the kind of thing you're asking for wasn't very often. And I mean, it took a long time to get to the effect sequences that even, you know, went to wide angle, I think. Did you see it that way?
John, what did you think? I mean, let's start with the first car race, and we just talk about it now, I guess, in terms of visual effects. So the first car race, almost straight out of the gate, as it were. Actually, we should start even before that. John, do you want to give us your opinion on the opening titles? Because Bond is famous for his opening titles.
I actually like the opening titles, despite them being done by MK12. I thought the opening titles were quite good. I thought they were really they were interesting. There was really slow motion, a lot of slow motion bullet work being done in the background, obviously, while the titles were happening. I thought some of that was really, really clever.
Mark, do you have a thought on the opening titles?
Yeah, it gave me more inspiration for things I would cover in an FX PhD course. Like, I thought it was a good opening. It's always nice to see somebody do their own take on it. You know, I mean, I think most people have their favorites. You know, so I don't think it was the best one, but I can never get rid of that Tomorrow Never Knows opening. That one was just like, that was like, a lot of people saw that one and felt like they'd already gotten their money's worth for the movie ticket by just watching that open.
Yeah, I must admit, I like, you know, was it Golden Gun where they were doing the gymnastics around the actual gun?
Yeah, yeah. Well, see, there you go. You want more sex, basically.
I basically want more sex.
You think that the women coming out of the sand and the objects in the sand was pretty clever, though?
I actually did. I actually thought it was good. And I thought it was everything you wanted out of a Bond title. It had, you know, Bond guns and, you know, interesting graphics. And this time there was a lot of, obviously, particle system stuff in the sand. So that was fine for me. I was like, I think I'd agree with Mark. Not necessarily the best one. Certainly on the money. Completely valid. I had no complaints. So let's get to the car chase then, right? So this is the first Aston Martin round the waterfront car chase. John, what do we think?
I think overall it was great. I mean, there was a lot to love about it. But for the first half of the car chase, I found it to be nearly impossible to understand. You know what was happening. It was a lot of just smash, jump, pow kind of cuts that really didn't make a lot of sense. And I was chuckling to myself because, you know, there's a point in which the cars are coming around and, you know, and they're saying, oh, there's a gray, you know, car and there's a black car, but then they come around and they're both black or there's yeah, three cars black. And they're all three black. And you're like, well, what the hell car am I supposed to be looking at? Bond's in the gray one, but there isn't a gray one.
Well, and then they removed one.
Yeah, exactly. Apparently.
Which just freaks me out. I don't know, with that much action, the idea of removing a car.
One of the things that's interesting is the second unit director, Dan Bradley, was actually second unit director of Bourne Supremacy and Bourne Ultimatum. Now, he's an ex-stunt director. Actually, he was a stuntman for like 30 years. And he basically specializes in second unit action stunt work. So it's not unsurprising, I guess, in a sense, that a second unit director of those two action films is going to produce something that we think is similar in the Bond films, although, of course, you know, visually he could go a different way. So
it's an important point, though, because the opening sequence of a Bond movie is kind of like the opening shot of a Star Wars movie. Like, there's a lot of expectation about, and it does set the film. And unless I'm wrong, I mean, in Casino Royale, it was that crazy parkour sequence with all of those like moving, you know, cranes and things that was all done by these amazing athletes pulling that off. And to me, that was really satisfying because it wasn't, fluffy hair James Bond with his parachute landing neatly at the bottom of, you know, the impossible, whatever, Mount Everest run or whatever. But it was actually real. It felt real, but it was really impressive. And we really got a good look at it. And it had that grand, like, pull back and see the whole thing. And, you know, it's true. This one was all, it was like they had to stay close in because they didn't have their actor there. They had an extra car they had to get rid of. I mean,
I think the visual effects were faultless, right? I mean, in terms of our barometer of how good an effects film is for its out-the-window composites of making you believe that they got the exposure right, I mean, in the brief milliseconds that I could glance to look, it looked like it was tracking beautifully and the exposure was perfect and the compositing was flawless, right? I guess for me, you actually hit it on the head, is that the Casino Royale opening thing, it was a kind of an original, fun, but hardcore, you know, brutal but exciting original thing to watch, including the ending of it where he goes to the consulate and actually, you know, takes out a bunch of guys. Whereas this one was like the car chase, and it's so hard to do a new car chase. I mean, you know, really, like, especially if it's a Bond one, you've got, you know, the expectation that there's no chance he's going to not do it. He's in an Aston Martin. Did you guys read that they actually trashed two Aston Martins? Not only did they trash an Aston Martin in filming it, but the guy from Aston Martin decided to drive the Aston Martin there because it was to a Bond film and he thought it'd be fun. And he himself, ripping around the foreshore of wherever that was, Geneva or whatever, put his own Aston Martin in the drink because he was like pretending to be James Bond. But anyway.
Yeah.
But I think
I guess there were a couple near misses because apparently somebody got pegged by the rig too when they were filming it and almost got thrown over the cliff.
Yeah. And I mean, it would be astonishingly hard to film. I mean, I can't begin to imagine how long it would take because every one of those has to be done in slow motion first at like 1 kilometer an hour and then work their way up so that the timing is right. And obviously editing gives you a lot, but still. Having said that, though, from an audience point of view, if you put that much effort into it, it'd be nice if it had a fresh twist for, albeit, you know, like, I mean, the foot chase sequence in Casino Royale had a fresh twist in the way that they kind of did it with the rigs and the jumping and stuff. So, anyway, faultless, just soulless.
Yeah, I agree. It was totally flawless in the visual effects part of it, absolutely.
And this is my thing I'll come back to every time this week, I bet you. It's flawless, but it's a bit soulless.
The interesting thing to me is that's that opening sequence with the car chase, and maybe I understand why they did this, but I really think that the thing that followed it, where they're jumping around on the rooftops and, you know, balancing on ledges and jumping across, I felt like I was there. That to me was, that should have been the opening. I thought I was just
spectacular. They had a self-imposed restraint here because they wanted this film to start 20 minutes after the end of the previous film. So they actually wanted the continuity of getting him, you know, out of I guess it was Venice.
Venice, or I think he'd actually gone I thought he'd gone to like Geneva, Lake Geneva or somewhere like that. It was when he shot the guy at the end of Casino Royale. You know, he'd gone to, were in Venice and he went chasing the bad guy.
Correct.
The guy who then escapes and then causes the chase sequence that John was talking about. So let's discuss that. There's a couple of things about that I think are interesting. Firstly, that was the second, we haven't discussed the first yet, but that's, the first major use of digital cinematography. So they were intermingling ARRI K2s for the horse race with the 35mm they were doing for the chase sequence. And I thought that intercut was technically identical. I mean, it just didn't strike me as one being digital and one being film. Did you pick on that? Yeah. Okay, so then there was a lot of wire work, and we've actually got some photos up on FX Guide, some behind-the-scenes stuff from the visual effects designer who very generously provided them. And there was just basically a ton of cranes going up, putting wires down so that Daniel Craig could do a lot of those stunts himself. And I agree with John. I think that was really well done. Like, that was both, you know, I don't know, exciting, dangerous, and just genuinely, like, you know, well shot. I mean, that jumping on the bus.
Yeah, I bet they didn't have to rig up those roof tiles to fall off either, man. It seems like if you just run around on those things, they'll just start sliding off of there.
Now, you know, John, when they, in that sequence, fall through the glass into the area where there's the scaffolding?
Yeah, absolutely.
That was, for me, in the cinema, the only time in the whole film where I went, oops, that looks digital.
Oh, really?
And that was a cut to apparently Pinewood for the fall. The fall was like a big piece.
It didn't look digital to me. It just looked totally staged.
Right, okay.
There was just that one scene, that one cut of maybe, you know, what, 2 seconds of footage. And I thought, what in the hell is that doing in there? That really...
That was the same
for
me.
There was something about it that really kind of took me out of it.
I was hoping you might be able to...
See, I had that. I mean, I had the aftertaste like you guys are talking about, but it was the first shot where I went, whoa, a big shot. Like, that was the first one where I felt like, okay, wow.
They pulled the camera back.
No, the second that they started to fall, I was like, there's something. I thought it was digital. I was actually hoping that I had you peg, John, that you were going to pick what it was that was causing us to think that. But there was something, I don't know if it was like a tonal thing or a motion blur thing, or there was something going around the edge of frame that just wasn't reading 100% right for me. Though I mean, you know, if I'd done the shot, I'd be incredibly proud of it. I mean, don't get me wrong, but it was the only, that was the first time, probably the only times that I was sort of almost looked for a pen to make a note for myself in the cinema.
It felt like a totally different lens for sure, right? That was a fact. I mean, it just felt like it was shot on a completely different lens.
Maybe so that was it, yeah.
Transition where you're like, okay, something just doesn't register properly with this at all.
What did you think, Mark?
I mean, like I said, I agree that the sequence, I mean, you could tell that suddenly they were into visual effects land, but in a way I also liked that. Like I kind of welcomed that because all of a sudden there was just something that felt too dangerous for two guys to really be doing it happening. Like when they did that fall, it suddenly felt like, you know, like we'd had all the life-size stuff happening, even the car chase, and now all of a sudden we were doing something larger than life. So my first reaction was to be more struck positively by it, you know, and the aftertaste wasn't so unpleasant for me either. But
I think the interior, then, you know, choreographed fight sequence with the ropes going up and down on the pulleys. See, if that for me was really well done. I didn't care whether it was studio or not.
And they did have to fake that whole environment, right?
And that looked good.
That was all fabricated. That chapel doesn't exist, they built a little bit of floor or something, right?
Yeah, I think that was a good sequence. I think it was like really sort of totally on the money. It was
cool. It was very spy versus spy too, how they were actually trying to undermine each other rather than fight each other directly. I thought it was funny.
I thought that was like classic Bond. It was sort of not witty, but it was definitely intelligent and well choreographed. And also I could tell what was going on. I lost it, you know, in brief cuts, but generally speaking, I knew who was up, who was down, who was upside down, where the gun was, then whether he was going to come around and get it again. You know, maybe
funny. I just used Mad Magazine spy versus spy to refer to the Bond spy versus spy.
Exactly. I thought that was really clever. It's interesting. Well, it's working out for you.
Yeah.
Interesting to me that, you know, in general, I mean, there's been a lot of comparison to the Bourne Ultimatum with this film. And, the only thing I have to say is I would push back so strongly on that because, yeah, there's some similarities in the same way that there's a trajectory for film to start being more close up and do a lot more dirty shots and, you know, these sort of things. But the one thing about the Bond film is they pulled back a lot more than Bourne Ultimatum did in a lot of ways. And, you know, Bourne Ultimatum to me, it's like really long lenses zoomed in like all the way to the edge and, you know, handheld. So the frame, you know, has like this 12-foot differential that it rotates on where it's just totally shaky. And, you know, even when someone's just sitting there talking, like somehow to make it exciting. And I didn't get the sense with this film that they were doing that. I got the sense that they were really close with the camera. I didn't get the sense that they were, you know, six blocks away with a zoom lens, just zoomed in all the way.
I think that's a very intelligent observation because I think that is exactly right now that you've articulated it. I mean, there was a sense of a spying eye in Ultimatum that, you know, it was looking in from afar, especially I can think of a shot in the in a restaurant where there was just tons of foreground and you were sort of sneaking a look at what was, you know, being said in the cafeteria versus, you're right, I mean, they were up close and gritty in Bond. And yet, you know, it's the style or the vibe of it and the sort of, you know, hard-paced professional fight sequences, I think, than the camera work that leans me to certainly say that it looked Bourne Ultimatum-ish. You know, it was very... you know, you think of one on when he runs across the roof and jumps across the thing through the window and to save the girl. And, you know, it's like another across the rooftop thing. And we had another across the rooftop in this one. And I mean, there are a lot of similarities.
I don't think anybody's going to complain, though, leaving the theater motion sick if they were sitting too close to the screen like they did with Bourne.
That's true.
Yeah, and that's exactly my point. That film, it had some, you know, really rough edges.
Ultimatum in particular felt like they were trying to own that as their style, you know, in the same way that you're talking about identifiable characteristics of Bond. It seemed like they were trying to really take that handheld thing, shaky cam, you know, and I mean, pre-Cloverfield, just make it theirs.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there are things that I like in Bond that I didn't get enough of. So, so therefore, it's not so much that I didn't like the Bourne ultimatumness of the Bond film. I just wanted a bit more soul. For example, right? Let's look at the guy who's the French actor who played our villain. Yeah. So the guy's name is totally escaped me. But anyway, his performance in the film is completely fine. Right?
Oh, do you want the actor's name or Dominic Green was the character?
Yeah, Dominic Green. I was trying to think of Almeric, is it his surname?
Almeric.
Almeric, yeah. Because he was in Munich, right? You know, the Spielberg film. And I guess my thing about him is he's a huge French star. He looks like a really good actor on screen. I just didn't think they gave him enough evil to do. You know, it's like I wanted him to be more evil. I didn't want him just to be a water leaseholder kind of corporate dude. I wanted him to be, you know, sneaky bad. I wanted him to do worse than we saw him do, or at least have more dimension to his evilness, you know.
He also was no Jaws. I mean, he wasn't really menacing. He was kind of dweeby.
I mean, yeah, and he's got a dweeby guy with a really bad haircut as his offsider who falls downstairs. I mean, they weren't like a formidable pair, you know. You kind of, I mean, when he was fighting Bond, I kind of didn't even think Bond would break into a sweat. He would just, you know, punch him twice and the guy'd cry. I'm not trying to say that
I felt that way a little bit too, by the way, Mike. My assumption was that because Bond was so rattled, it took him a little bit of time to kind of get himself together. Because if you look at that sequence, Bond had just gone through a tremendous amount. He hadn't slept in days. All of these problems happened. He was weak. He fell through a rooftop. You know, things fell on him.
Okay, hang on a second. But let me call you on that, though. He sees the girl dead in the apartment, covered in oil, and he takes out three of his own agents without killing them in the elevator when he's handcuffed with his hands tied behind his back, right? And they're meant to be guarding him and on, you know, like aware. So three guys get taken out in an elevator who are armed. He's like got both hands tied behind his back. And that situation took, what, 2 seconds to take all three guys out? And yet this Dominic Green, who's shown no real physical prowess, it just didn't seem like a formidable fight opponent. We didn't know him to be a black belt in anything or a, you know, ex-Navy SEAL or anything. He just seemed like a guy who was really good at, you know, structuring deals and threatening people.
Well, he did kind of go berserk, though. I mean, if you watch that scene, he just wails on Bond and, you know, to the point where he actually swings so hard that he ends up hitting himself in the foot with an axe.
Well, anyway, I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with Dominic Green. I just don't think he has a lot of soul. Do you know what I mean? It's not a criticism of him being a bad actor or it being a hopeless dialogue or it just, you know, it just wasn't memorably, amazingly kind of cool, unexpectedly odd, weird, sicko, weird, demented, or even that particularly
he's the
evil
new bad
maniacal
guy. I mean, right? The new bad guy is the really smart, like Bill Gates type, who's, you know, who's putting it all together. I mean,
is that the best we can do, though? I mean, really?
I mean, in the long line of Bond villains at Madame Tussauds, this dude would not even merit a statue, I don't think.
Yeah. But you know, as I said, I liked the film.
It's
I
just not think memorable.
It's, yeah, it's awesome. Just not a, exactly. The whole film for me is good and well done, but just in, it just didn't lift it to a new place. And it certainly didn't, I mean, there were some great aspects to it, don't get me wrong. I thought the really nice typography on the, when they went to each city, and there was some really interesting stuff with a whole lot of aspects about it. But, you know, just lacking a bit of soul, a bit of like, you know, there was no point at which I wanted to sort of jump out of my seat and kind of, yeah, kick ass, go on, get him kind of thing. Hey, what did we think, if we get back to visual effects, about the biggest effect sequence in the film probably, which was the plane crashing or exploding midair, parachuting out, and effectively base jumping down with one chute.
Right. Well, can we tackle that in two different pieces? Because the former I could talk about all day long as how much I loved it, and the latter I thought was just a colossal failure.
Okay, so let's discuss the former.
So the plane itself, the catching on fire and the engine failing and going through the mountains and those, I mean, I was shocked to see how much of that was digital replacement. You know, I've seen a lot of the before and after stills, and I am just mesmerized by how good it was.
Yes, we have some before and after skills on FX Guide, and you're right. There are some sequences that were entirely digital, and there are sequences where the background was fully replaced, and the plane, you know, had all its smoke coming out of its engine added in post. Well, I should say planes, because it was the plane and the attack plane that was following it.
Well, what's kind of interesting about that is I don't know if there's any big element though in this film where they didn't have a physical reference that they put on film, like. In all the cases, I think, of the CG, they also shot a real one and, you know, so had ready reference to match as opposed to doing it entirely from scratch. I mean, that's the type of film this was.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the visual effects designer, Kevin Haag's work is known for that kind of, you know, get it in camera if you can. And when he can't, he's completely not lacking in digital prowess. I mean, his credits from Stranger Than Fiction and, I mean, his stuff with David Fincher as well. Like, it's all really, really good stuff. But you're right, the plane was...
So, like, having looked at the behind-the-scenes stuff, we know that the plane going down, like, all that smoke was all CG smoke. But I didn't think about it. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but it didn't even occur to me to think about it as I was watching it.
No, I didn't think about it either. I thought that that aspect of it was phenomenal. I thought my whole point about the plane was every single thing that they did with the plane while they were flying through the canyon, when it caught on fire, all of that I thought was just so good and so well done. I mean, even the explosions, which frankly are for me a lot of times the thing that I can always pinpoint as being CG. Because there's just something about, if you've ever seen a real explosion, which Mike, we know you have recently.
Recently, yeah.
If you've ever seen a real explosion, it just, no matter how much debris and crap you put in it, it just doesn't look, I mean, it looks different, right? There's just something about it. There's something about an organic explosion that it's almost impossible to mimic.
Which is why
these explosions felt predominantly,
well, they predominantly were, especially the end sequence. Those were all real.
Yeah, I think we're talking about in the plane sequence. I mean, you know, what John's referring to first.
Not so much blowing up there, but yeah.
But I mean, that's why we shoot miniature explosions, right? Like, well, in our case, we were shooting for our project, we shot, you know, scaled explosions. Because you want that spontaneity of what flames do when they kind of envelop themselves and stuff. But you're right. I mean, I thought it was really good. And to tell you a funny story, I was going up to shoot in Queensland, which is kind of like, not a particularly long way, but, you know, enough that I'm sitting in the seat for a fairly long time. And the in-flight entertainment I didn't choose to partake of. I was actually listening to podcasts. Actually, I was actually listening to one of your podcasts, John. So I've got my headphones on. But, you know, when you look up a plane blindly staring ahead, you get the back of everybody else's seats. And there was just this trailer running for Quantum of Solace, which was more than a trailer. It was a kind of a making-of trailer. And so I must have seen in that trip them flying real planes through the real canyons to make this shot like 20 times, right? So when someone actually got to see it in the cinema, I was completely convinced that it was all done in camera because, you know, I'd just seen that over and over and over again on the back of the headsets on other people's in-flight entertainment. And so it was only after that that I got to work out how much digital stuff they'd done. And I was like, wow, that's really good. And I was sort of so lulled into a sense of having seen them standing on the canyon floor and flying these suckers through with Wes cams and stuff to film it all. So I guess the thing is, if you think it's real, you know, it certainly sold it as real. And if you were expecting visual effects, maybe you could have picked it. But we're in agreement, aren't we, that the plane stuff was great?
Mm-hmm.
So then that leaves the skydiving.
I just want to say I thought it failed. The moment they left the plane, I could tell that it was really quick and sloppy roto work.
Well, okay, let's explain how they did it firstly. They jumped out of not a plane, but actually a wind tunnel called Body Flight, which is the largest, I think it was the first one in Britain, but certainly the largest sort of jet engine turned on its end cylinder that you sort of literally get inside of, and it blasts you with a jet engine, and the literal volume of air rushing up means that you effectively float and suspended. And I'm sure you guys have seen these things that
I've done.
I did it for my birthday this year.
Okay.
Yep. With my kids.
What's it like?
Well, all the ripply skin on the face is definitely what they caught. That is definitely what happens with that amount of wind blowing up. And there was no other way to get that.
I understood that there's a limit to how long you can do this for because it dries out your eyes and stuff unless you're wearing goggles. Is that?
Yeah. When you pay your money and just show up, you're wearing goggles.
Right.
And yeah, so, you have to.
But they weren't when they were filming the real actors. No. In this wind tunnel in Britain, right?
Have you ever actually been skydiving, either of you?
Nope.
No.
So the one thing I would say, and this is maybe the thing that just didn't sell it for me, is the difference between being in one of these wind tunnels and actually skydiving is your face is just not blown back and rippling and all of that in the same way when you actually skydive.
Okay.
I mean, you know. I mean, think about it. You're falling. There's a huge difference between you falling, and certainly winds rushing past you and all that. There's a difference between that and a giant jet turbine blowing enough air to lift you off the ground. I mean, you have to think about the difference, just from a physics perspective, the difference that's going to happen on your body. And so I think maybe that's part of what I just went, oh, come on. When I saw that, I just thought, this is out of control.
So I have no experience in skydiving, and I applaud you for doing it because I'm way too much of a chicken to jump out of a plane and imagine that a tissue is going to hold me from killing myself as I plummet downwards. There are millions of years of evolution in my body that says it's a bad idea to jump out of tall buildings or out of planes.
It's the brashness of youth. I was a kid.
Okay, but let's say for a second that we discounted the face thing. What do we actually think about the comps? Because the problem with the wind tunnel as I guess it's obvious when you say it, is it's a constricted space. You can't get a long way away from them, right? You have to be either under them, above them, but you certainly can't get a long way away from them in a wide shot sense, which leads to the relatively fast cutting up close or incredibly distant comped nature of the sequence. Did they get value for money? I mean, could you have got that with just some wire work?
I don't think so. It was it's a weird looking sequence for sure. Like it looks kind of odd, and it's worth saying too, they shot it all on Dalsos, the now late lamented Dalsa Origin, which may have also contributed a little bit to the odd look of it. I can't say that for sure, but you know, this is a grainless 4K camera, and I don't know. I mean, the whole thing, it was a little bit like, I want to say it was a little bit like the action sequences in Gladiator with the lack of, the lack of shutter angle blur on them. Like there was just something really strange.
Well, I should point out there was actually 16 cameras, of which 8 were Dalsas. 7 were actually were not Dalsas. They were the Cine Altas, the Sony cameras. They only had 8, but they were feeding out to a bunch of Kodak disc recorders. But what's interesting is that they actually said that because of the data wrangling, it would have been faster to shoot the darn thing on film and had the film scanned than it would have been to do it the way they did. But they did get really...
Yeah, which may be why Dalsas out of business now.
They did get really clean, 4K stuff to work with without obviously any kind of...
I am not hitting it on the head here, but... You know, there was just something really strange looking about those, and I'd have to go back and study them again to see exactly what it was.
I think, as I started out by saying, I think it was just sloppy roto, and I'm sorry to say that because I know that Double Negative worked on it and they do great work, but this thing was done really fast. Maybe they farmed it out. To me, I could see so much garbage and blur around, both the characters. It took me out of it so bad. Mark, you were next to me. I actually laughed out loud when that scene happened.
Well, but am I wrong? I mean, the roto work was actually rotoing 3D shapes to replace the ripples in their face so that they could reproject these actors as 3D characters. I mean, there was a certain amount of that, right?
Not there was, for the close-ups. A certain amount of reprojecting them onto geometry. Well, of course, the other problem is they were shooting through wire because you don't have your actor sitting above a jet turbine without a huge piece of wire mesh. And so their whole bodies, as you can see, if you look at the before and after plates on our site, there's like a grid of wire across their entire bodies. So it isn't just right around the outside. You had to, you know, paint out across their bodies all of the wire meshing that was otherwise faintly across, you know, the entire length and breadth of every part of them during the fall. I guess for me, I mean, I applaud the technology of doing it. I don't know that it was stunningly brilliant in its end delivery. And I think if you'd done, I mean, if you were going to go to that extent, I probably, I don't know, like, I mean, how hard would it be to convince Daniel Craig to actually,
filmed them and then done facial replacement?
Or even just got the actors to jump out of planes and remove the parachutes off their backs. Because, I mean, is it just that the insurance company wouldn't let Daniel Craig jump out of a plane? Yeah, I mean, they let him jump on top of a jet.
But you don't need Daniel Craig. Jump out, right? You're far enough back, you could just do face replacements. And it's
not for the
close-ups.
Well,
that's not what they wanted at all. They wanted those close-ups for sure.
Yeah, totally. I mean,
yeah, but if you look at it, they aren't that close.
Oh, there's some real close-ups.
Well, some of them were. Yeah.
But you could do those anywhere, right? I mean, I'm not trying to be a contrarian. I'm just saying this is a visual effects fail to me.
But you couldn't have got the what you hate rippling on the faces the way they did easily without doing what they did, right?
And they they committed to that and, you know, happened.
Okay, so we didn't like the drop and we thought that it was, like, not working for them. But I guess I don't feel as strongly as... But then I have no...
No, you know, I don't
being a coward, I have no frame of reference of what it should have looked like.
The landing, it was... You know, the absolute worst thing you could have done to put a cherry on top of a scene that I was already having trouble swallowing.
The night before, I'd watched Get Smart with, the new Get Smart, where they, you know, fall and the guy without a parachute lands on a pig and survives a drop from 10,000 feet. And I just kept on dropping on pig flashbacks when they went into that ravine.
For a second, I thought he landed on the girl to save himself. That would not have been very Bond-like.
No. So what do we think of our incredibly poorly designed, if you mind that noise, it's just the foreboding about the power cells that I have to, you know, telegraph at this point. We don't use building codes in this part of the world. Hotel.
Yeah, do fuel cells really do that? Are they that unstable?
I don't think so. But if they did, I don't think you'd use them per room.
Yeah.
But yes, apparently some kind of
propane
lethal...
and propane related. Anyway.
Yeah. We have small explosive devices fitted to your room, and here's the air conditioning switch. But I mean,
with faulty wiring.
Yeah. So, I mean, apart from the cascading failure of the system to actually have any kind of sprinkler, even though they were in the water hoarding business, what do we actually think of that end sequence? Was it good? Did we like it? Did we like him?
It was great.
Yeah?
It was great. Full of real explosions that looked cool.
I mean, I think there was amazing stunt work, yeah.
Yeah, and then nice enhancements of, you know, like adding, I mean, and again, this I had to learn about after the fact, but like they added some smoke coming off Daniel Craig just so he'd look like he was closer to the real danger than they put him when he was on the set, of course. You know, just clever things like that.
So I guess the thing is, if we're going to summarize the film, it was a really good visual effects film. It was a good Bond film. And for some of us, it wasn't a great Bond film, but it's definitely worth going and having a look at. Is that a summary? Is that a fair summation?
Yeah, I would say so. I don't want to see this thing get too vindicated. I think it was riding on the coattails of the previous film a lot. And I am. It's in the scary category for me of how aggressively they made it. I think the houses in London did an amazing job, and I hope their lives weren't too miserable for having had to do it on that kind of schedule. That's my concern, because I think it did suffer from how rushed it was. And I mean, this director, apparently the producers don't think he'll speak to them again in one of the articles I read. And, you know, I just, I just think that somebody had a brutal yoke on this thing. And, you know, I do want to say that the spectacular opening weekend and the really great numbers it's stringing up, I think, are partly riding on the coattails of the other one. But it's also a really good follow-up.
John, for you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I love the director. So I would probably literally see anything that he ever did. And I thought that this was, even given everything that, you know, we've talked about the rushed schedule and some of the effects didn't work at 100% and those sort of things, I still thought it was really good. I mean, you could tell there are places where the plot faltered and they corrected it by, assembling an edit that kind of wove its way around a plot that was just not put together very well.
I just like them to do more Harry Potter, where they plan these things out, give people time, and when they get to the crunch, they give them an extra 6 months to make it good, than rushing it out in 12 weeks. I couldn't agree more. Hey, I've got to fly because I have some commitments, but thank you so much both for being here. Mark, do you want to plug a book or a site?
I have actually the new edition of my After Effects. It has a very long title now, but it's After Effects Visual Effects Compositing and Studio Techniques. Anyway, it's out, or it will be soon. It should be out around Christmas, but it's on its way to the printer now. That's exciting. And you can find me as Flow Seeker on Twitter. Right now I am at, I believe, 199 followers. I'm late to the game. And you could be number 200, whoever's listening out there.
Well, I know that it's going to be a cracker of a book because I love your work. So we're looking forward to that. Good Christmas,
thanks,
Christ. And John, your newly married status, I presume we can still catch up with you on your podcast, which haven't changed?
No, podcasts haven't changed. I'm actually launching a new one and working on a web series right now and some other things.
Excellent.
You can find out all about that at lifezero.org, and I have links to everything there.
Great. And of course, our stuff's over at FX Guide, and you can look at and keep up to date with what we're doing here on the VFX show at vfxshow.com.
So also, I'd just like to say thanks to producer Kristen Martin, who does a great job at kind of wrangling these things. Kevin Hansen does some work, and Lori Apthorpe also. I believe she did the show notes this time.
She does
them with some frequency. So thanks, guys.
Yeah, Christian does a great job, and we appreciate it. And I actually mispronounced her name. At least we think that it sounds like I do with my accent, but I apologize because she is an absolutely linchpin of the team. And she also runs all the website stuff. So thank you to her. And as I say, to Larry for the show notes. We really appreciate that. I have to go, guys. I will talk to you later. It's been fun. Let's look forward to next week, and hopefully we can all join up then. Until then, see you guys later. Bye.